different kinds of expansions of the universe to the measured values. So they actually like to take the logarithm of this luminosity distance and compare it to the universe that there is no matter in it. And this is what they're usually plotting on their plots, okay? So they did these measurements in 1998, and what they found was that the results can be fitted very well with the matter density of the order of 0.3 and the cosmological constant whose energy density is about 70% of the critical density. Or, I mean, it's not that restrictive, the measurements are not that precise, so it's not clear whether it's a cosmological constant or some other sort of dark energy where the equation of state is sort of close to minus 1, it's less than minus 0.6 or 0.7. So, from these measurements, the usual conclusion is that there must be some sort of uniformly distributed dark energy. And by dark energy, they mean some sort of matter that is not clumping, it's not forming like galaxies or anything, and which have negative tension, so the equation of state is close to minus 1, and which makes up about 70% of the total energy density. So the question for particle physicists is, what could this be? And what people usually are saying is, well, there's just a cosmological constant. There's some vacuum energy density which makes the universe accelerate. Now, the problem with this is that the actual value that is needed for explaining these measurements is about 60 orders of magnitude smaller than what someone doing particle physics would expect. But of course, this is just a cosmological constant problem, so it's not so surprising.
Or, do you claim that any value other than zero is unnatural, right? That's what you are saying. There are two.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
To the four,
well, PV to the fourth, maybe.
Sometimes use it to the
fourth.
That's
right.
That's for the
that's the 60 orders of magnitude.
Kind of or zero.
It's not kind of the same because no particle physics theory predicts the value of cosmological constant. So
yes.
It's. I mean, when you are saying that can write, you're implying that it has a finite theory, which is not the case, right? So in this way, when you are saying that the equation P could then, I mean, density related to P, it's the same coefficient equal to minus 1, what is the phenomenological way to differentiate it for cosmological constant? Because you see, it's, in a sense, it's like a name, right?
Yes.
Whatever
so, okay.
Has this feature, you can call cosmological.
Yeah,
constant.
I agree. Anyway, we know that a cosmological constant is bad. Another way that cosmologists are trying to explain this accelerating universe is to say that we have a scalar field. It's not really settled yet to its minimum, but it's still rolling. And that could give you an equation of state that is not exactly minus 1. But it could be somewhat larger than minus 1, due to the fact that the equation of state for a scalar field is just given by this ratio. And obviously, if phi dot squared is non-zero yet, then you could deviate from minus 1. However, the problem with this is that this is not more natural in any sense. Namely, due to the slow roll condition, due to the fact that phi dot is not yet zero, this means that the mass of the scalar field has to be much smaller than the current Hubble scale, which is 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. So you need an extremely light scalar field, which, again, is a very strong fine-tuning problem.
You need that on top of the minimum being small.
Yes, that's right.
No, but in this way, this curve field is essentially, it's again like cosmological constants mainly. Right?
Basically, yes.
So it's
even worse, yes, because you have to the cosmological constant plus the mass of the scalar field. So I guess for particle physicists, for astrophysicists, these are just parameters, so they don't worry so much about these issues. But for particle physicists, these observations do cause severe problems. Namely, there's the severe fine-tuning problem, and there's also an interpretational problem, an even more basic fundamental conceptual problem. Namely, if the equation of state is less than minus one-third, the universe would be eternally accelerating, and so there would be some horizons in the theory, and any observer would have only a finite amount of information. So it would be very hard to define some S matrix, and I guess I'm not the biggest expert on this, but it causes a conceptual challenge to define quantum gravity in any theory like this. Okay. However, what I should emphasize is that really the only observation that is requiring the equation of state to be less than minus one-third is the supernova measurement. And so in essence, what we have is we have a single experiment. We are making a single new model, a new explanation, an explanation for this. And seeing this, one could ask the question, you know, is this necessarily the only possible explanation that one could have for this measurement?
Of course, omega is one, so you're postulating some other dark matter that would have to be part of the story as well.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes, that is hard to circumvent. I will come to that. Anyway, so people have tried actually to find other explanations, more conventional explanations for these supernova measurements, but turns out to be not very easy to find something that would fit everything. People were first asking the obvious question, isn't there just some dust that would absorb, you know, a certain fraction of light coming from the supernovae? However, this would be a problem because this dust would somehow re-emit light and screw up the microwave background measurements. Now people were saying, okay, but what if I have some special kind of dust where the grain size is chosen in some very particular way that would not do this with the CMB? Still, this is not very good because it turns out that there are some measurements at very high Z, and when there is a cosmological constant, at early times, of course, still matter would dominate, and the universe would not have been accelerating at very early times. For example, at the value of these particular measurements, the universe would not have been cosmologically constant dominated, but matter dominated. And that means that this effect with the dust, of course, if there is dust in the universe, would not saturate at large values of Z. However, the...
I don't understand. Dust won't give you negative pressure, right?
Yes, but it would just... It would not give... It's a different interpretation. It's
okay.
Not...
So
it's not
saying, there is dust, forget about what I said in the very beginning.
Exactly, forget.
Need negative pressure.
Yes, exactly.
Explain the data in a totally different...
Absolutely,
way.
Yes. And but the problem is that this would not saturate because it would... kill more and more fraction of the light as you go further and further away, and this is not what happens in the observations. And similarly, people were thinking about maybe the supernovae are actually not really standard candles, but they are evolving, and this has the same kind of problem. It can explain the data up to one Z equals one, but when it comes to the very early stuff, it cannot explain the measurements. At actually it's just one or two data points, so it's not clear. It's just one or, yeah, so maybe I shouldn't make such a big deal out of it, but you know.
So you would say, I'm getting the impression on you that the dust calculation is in very good shape.
It's not in very good shape.
Yes. It is in good shape, but not in good shape.
It's not because it doesn't saturate.
No,
that's
no,
what
no,
I would say.
It's a reliable calculation that people have done.
No, they don't know how much dust there is.
Yeah, so I mean,
I have no opinion of this.
I mean, spermatopoeia is completely a mess.
I have no opinion of this.
I think the general feeling, the 1.7 supernova, there's only one.
Yes.
And it's got huge error bars on it.
Right.
So you don't want to pin everything you're saying on that one supernova. So with the dust, it's still hard to do. I mean, given everything we know about dust, it has to be radiated somewhere, and we just don't see it re-radiating. So there's a tiny little parameter space where it could still be re-radiating and we wouldn't have another thing yet. That'll supposedly close up at some point. So I think that's really where it is. So we think we understand dust enough to know that if it's stealing all this light from the supernova, it's not showing up anywhere else.
Okay, so what we were interested in is it possible to modify particle physics such that we could get somehow, we could lose somehow about 30% of the photons such that after Z equals 1 there is a saturation, and also such that the microwave background photons are not affected at all. Okay, so we have tried different things. Obviously you have to mess around somehow with the properties of the photon. And we were thinking, well, maybe the photon has a small mass that's not excluded, but it also doesn't diminish the intensity. Maybe the photon has some small widths, but it also probably would not saturate at Z equals 1. So what we thought is that the only thing that could possibly work is maybe if photons are oscillating into some other particles. And the analogy of this would be that if we had neutrino oscillations, and the only thing we saw from the Sun were the neutrinos, and that's how we would try to measure the distance of the Sun, then we would just conclude that, well, the Sun is further away than we would normally expect it, because we would not be thinking about the possibility of neutrinos oscillating into each other. So the question is, can photons oscillate into some other particles, and could it give you the right kind of experimental results for the supernovae? So it has been known for a long time that photons can oscillate, for example, into scalars, some pseudo-scalar particles called axions, and this was the way it was originally proposed by Sikivi to test for the existence of the so-called invisible axions. Namely, if you have a axion field that couples to FF dual, and in a background magnetic field, there would be an oscillation induced between the axion field and the photon field. And so the strength of this coupling and the strength of the oscillation will be parametrized by this coupling constant M. And so again, if there is a constant background magnetic field, which there is in the universe, then photons and axions would be oscillating into each other. And this is the equation that a propagating light beam would be satisfying, where this little m is the axion mass. And from this, by diagonalizing the mixing matrix, you can find out what the mixing angle and the oscillation length for this process would be. And it depends again on the value of the background magnetic field, the energy, the strength of the coupling, and the axion mass. And also here is the formula for the oscillation length. And now the very important thing is that the supernova measurements, they see a reduction in the amount of light, which is independent of the energy, independent of what frequency light they are looking at. And it looks like that if this term is actually dominating the axion mass, then you would actually just get a maximal mixing in the theory.
What's epsilon?
Epsilon is the energy of the photon. This is the energy of the photon. So it's coming from the derivative from the... So it turns out that for energies that are larger than this quantity, this is the axion mass, this is the coupling, and this is the magnetic field, there will be maximal mixing and completely independent of the energy of the photon, and the oscillation length would also be completely independent of the photon energy. However, once you go below this threshold defined by this axion mass, etc., the mixing will become very small. So this shows that there is a possibility for getting an energy-independent, relatively large mixing with a large oscillation length for certain energy regimes, which can then be cut off by the existence of this axion mass. So this tells you that it's possible to make the CMB photons be unaffected by this cutoff if this M is picked such that this cut happens exactly between the visible light and between CMB photons.
Which means what parameter range for
them? I will come to it. So again, this is how we want to choose the axion mass, such that the optical photons would have maximal and energy independent mixings, and the CMB photons would have very small mixing and it would not be distorted. However, if this was just the end of the story, this could still not explain the observations. The point is that if there was a uniform magnetic field, then you would lose up to 50% of the intensity. And this is not in agreement with the measurements. Only about 30% of the luminosity is lost. However, the magnetic field, luckily, is not uniform in the universe, but rather it's uniform in a certain size of domain, and then the directions are changing. So what we are assuming is that the domain size for the magnetic field is of the order of 1 megaparsec, and then we assume that the direction of the magnetic field in the different domains is just randomly varying. Well, people don't really know it. There are observational bounds. So there's an upper bound, and then there is also a likely value from the fact that within galaxies, you know that there are relatively large magnetic fields, and the flux has to go somewhere. Okay, so people think, okay, I will come to this, how big it is. But the important message that I would like to get through is that if you actually average these oscillations over many thousand domains, which would be happening if you have domains of the size of 1 megaparsec and these supernovae are of the order of 4 or 5,000 megaparsecs away, then due to the fact that the photon has 2 degrees of freedom and the axion has 1 degree of freedom, in the end, the averaged loss of the photon intensity will actually go to 2/3 instead of 1/2. And so we have done simulations about this by averaging over many type of magnetic field configurations, but you can actually show it analytically too, that in the end the loss of the photon intensity would converge to about 2/3. And the analytic formula that the averaged curve is obeying is given here. So for y equals 0, it's obviously 1, and then for very large y, it goes to 2/3. And this decay length is depending on the size of the magnetic domains, and again on this on the size of the magnetic field and the coupling. Okay. So
the parameters are too small to see the effect of, say, this single domain or the magnetic field of, say, our galaxy.
Well, I come to our galaxy, yeah, but yeah, of course, I mean, the oscillation length is huge. So within one domain, there is just a very, very small oscillation. So you wouldn't see it in any terrestrial experiment or anything.
Say that every faraway event,
yes,
astronomers have seen,
yes,
ever,
yes, is much further. Yeah, it's much closer.
50%
yes.
More luminous.
Yes, well, not 50, but yeah, somewhat more luminous. Yes. Yes. Okay, so now...
Will that get you into trouble again with this question of the age of the stars versus the age of the universe?
Not really, no. I come to the constraints on that too. Okay, so let's try to see now what kind of parameters you would need in order for this mechanism to work. So this basically tells you that, in order, just roughly, a rough estimate tells you that, so the decay length should be roughly of the order of the Hubble scale. And in order to get that, so first of all, we are taking a magnetic field which is sort of close to the upper bound, observational upper bound, which is for 1 megaparsec domain sizes would be 10 to the minus 8 Gauss, and we are picking something of the order of 5 times 10 to the minus 9. But it's not so unreasonable to pick this number, because just based on flux conservation, people think that there should be magnetic field of the order of 10 to the minus 9 Gauss, at least. It's called some Faraday rotations, and the bounds are only where there is matter, so it's not very strong. And it depends also very crucially on what the correlation length of the, what the domain length of the magnetic field is. So the larger it is, the stronger the bound is. And also, we are picking the axion coupling to be close to its experimental bound. There are two kinds of bounds on the axion photon coupling. One is direct bound from experiments on Earth, and the more strong one is based on the same effect from supernova 1987A, where the point is that high energy photons could not escape from the inside of the supernovae. However, because there are large magnetic fields within the supernovae, some of the high energy photons, by the same effect, would oscillate into axions. Those could escape from the supernovae, and then by the galactic magnetic field, it could turn over into photons again, and it would give you gamma ray bursts, and those have not been observed. And those give you the strongest bound on the photon-axion coupling. And so we are choosing something that is slightly just outside the bound. And that would give you the right kind of oscillation lengths for this theory. And from these, you can find out, with these parameters, the size of the axial mass that you would need in order to have the cut between the maximal mixing and the no mixing, just between the optical and the CMB photons, to be of the order of 10 to the minus 16 electron volts. However, as pointed out here by Steve, of course, we cannot circumvent the constraint that omega total is still 1. So we still have to assume that there is some sort of dark energy in the universe. And for simplicity and concreteness, we are assuming that it's, for example, made out of a network of cosmic strings, which would give you omega equals minus 1/3, and there would be no acceleration.
What other alternatives would work?
Well, I mean, anything omega less than minus 1/3 would work, but this is something concrete that could come from some
kind of, maybe not very polite question. What, why a network of cosmic strings is so much better than having cosmological constant? Right?
Well, that's, I think it's less, to me, that's a conceptually less challenging new physics than a cosmological constant. Well,
if
like,
you have a developed network of cosmic strings which evaded detection so far, so it's pretty
yes.
much over fine tuning, right? I mean, that we didn't see them,
yes.
and it's, it breaks all sorts of Lorentz and other invariances.
Yes.
And
but for example, there is no problem with the future horizons.
So this constraint omega minus 1/3 applies
without
supernova.
Omega is this is just made up. We just wanted to pick some number that
so
is.
Omega has to be less than minus 1/3, even if you don't.
In order to not have acceleration in the universe,
oh.
yes, because a double dot is somehow proportional to rho plus 3p. Okay, that's what a double dot is. Well, because okay. Well, that's the question. Unclamping, you know, is it reasonable to assume that something with omega positive is not clumping.
Omega negative. Ah, positive.
Yes. Yes.
Let me say, why not photinos? I mean, we know that dark energy is dark matter is supposed to.
Well, because people say that the clumping matter is just one-third.
I got you. Photinos can't be the whole
yes.
one.
They yes. Point three. They are 0.3, yes. And I'm talking about the 0.7. So this would be the 0.7, for example.
So you can't use quaternion oscillations of this axion field?
Not of this axion field, no. Those are too small.
But also, it's the examples of, search for axion, right? And there is a kind of small window which is where I do not remember which one.
Not for this very low mass.
But it's kind of limited window only which is allowable.
You mean for the strings?
No, for axion.
Not with this small mass. For this, there is no constraint.
Yeah.
I mean, the constraint is on the coupling. It's on the strength of the coupling.
Well, because it's more a standard axion, the coupling and the mass are related, as you know.
That's right. So I will come to that.
Yeah.
What kind of model could give this?
Also, I wanted to ask kind of a cosmological question, because if you are right, then it means that if we observe something which is within a distance of, say, one magnetic field, domain, the loss is going to be larger, right? Because there is no, there would be no, on one hand it's already one domain, there is full oscillation. Yeah. On the other
One magnetic domain, the oscillation is very small.
We'll see. Okay,
the oscillation probability is very small.
Okay, let's take whatever is one oscillation length. Okay?
Oh, but you want to create a magnetic field, coherent magnetic field that large?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but how do you create coherent magnetic field of the order of the universe?
What do we know about intergalactic magnetic fields?
Okay, so for that is probably excluded because the size of the magnetic field, the experimental limit on the size of the magnetic field depends strongly on the coherence length.
Yeah.
And if it's completely uniform, then I think it must be. I think. I don't remember how it goes.
But
I
mean, if the photon has a mass, that bound may be changed, huh?
I'm sorry?
That bound may be
changed. Oh, if the photon has a mass.
Because astrophysicists assume that's what you claim.
That's true.
This way, if the photon has a mass, you already have kind of axion, right? Because
yes, that can...
Works a little bit as an axion, right?
Anyway...
Yes, also, I mean, just one other thing is that... CMB anisotropy has problems with cosmic strain.
Mm-hmm.
So does structure formation. So you've got I understand this.
This is just as an example.
But there is a problem that I think if you really want to come up with a bias.
Well, with structure formation, I'll comment on this. Okay, so. With this particular choice of parameters, CMB would be unaffected. The luminosity distance versus the redshift plot would be basically indistinguishable from that what you get from the accelerating universe. So this dashed line is the accelerating universe, and the solid line would be the case where you have some string that makes 70% of the energy density, and omega matter is 0.3 plus the oscillations that we have discussed here. And so to see how much this is different from the non-accelerating versions, this is when omega matter is 1, and this would be when omega matter is 0.3, and there would be also strings but no oscillations. So you can see that these two curves are basically indistinguishable. And
I guess I just don't follow that, because you told us a few minutes ago that everything, all the cosmological objects are much closer than we thought. How does that affect the determination, for example, of the Hubble constant? Does that go back up to 1?
No, the Hubble constant is determined basically from the very early part of this curve, where the oscillations are very small yet. So that is not affected.
Okay. Do you have to worry about polarization?
Okay, yes, absolutely yes, I will come to that too. Okay, so let me let me say also that, you know, indistinguishable basically also means that you can do the chi-squared fits, and you can see that really the chi-squared is almost indistinguishable from the accelerating universe. So this will be the accelerating universe, and this would be the scenario with the axial and cosmic string. So the question is now, yes, what other constraints do we know? So is this excluded based on any other considerations or measurements or not? So again, from CMB, it's very hard to circumvent omega total equals 1, and omega matter is 0.3. So as I said, we still did assume that there's some string or something that makes up 70% of the energy. But as I was telling you before, if this is greater than minus 1/3, there would be no acceleration. And if it's greater than minus 0.48, there would be no current acceleration. But this would not resolve the conceptual issue about future acceleration. Now, I was trying to look at these other measurements, what they would tell you about the equation of state. And it turns out that the peak in the CMB is relatively sensitive on what the actual value of the of omega matter is. So, for example, if you allow it to just go up to 0.35, then the preferred value of the equation of state would go down from CMB to minus 0.35. So this, I would say, is not very restrictive at the moment. The age of the universe at 1 sigma requires only that this equation of state is less than minus 0.2, so it would also leave you the range open. Now, I did not find structure formation on its own, but I found some combined fits of CMB plus structure formation, and it looked like at 2 sigma level, omega is less than minus 0.25, so seems that it's not excluded with that either, and galaxy counts at the moment don't seem to be very restrictive on the value of the equation of state of the dark energy. But in planned future surveys, they will be able to pin this down independently from the supernovae. So I would argue that all the other independent constraints are consistent with omega equals minus 1/3 or minus 0.3. And it's only the supernovae that are actually forcing you to go to a much smaller value. Now here to Henry's question, okay? So there are faraway objects that are observed, some quasars, and they have polarizations, okay? And at the same mechanism that in this random direction magnetic field is turning photons into axions would also, as I said, would equilibrate between the 3 degrees of freedom, the two photons and the axions. So it would degrade polarization, okay? Now, the lucky thing is that the polarization is decaying much more slowly than the light intensity. And the reason is you can understand that easily because in order to degrade polarization, you have to first turn the photon into an axion, and then that axion has to turn back into the other type of photon. That's how polarization is degraded. So it's a second order effect. That's why it is slower. So I mean, we didn't make any real qualitative, discussions about it, but it looks like since it's degrading slower and, you know, 8,000 megaparsec is already a relatively large Z, that it doesn't seem to be a problem. But I agree that maybe, you know, some more detailed analysis of this would be useful.
Why is that second order?
Okay, so assume you have a completely polarized light, yes? Yeah. Then, you know, then intensity is already diminishing when the photon just turns into an axion.
Good.
Okay?
Yeah.
But in order for polarization to diminish, but the polarization by that was still 100%.
What do you mean? I mean, when you converted a photon into an axion.
Yeah, but then you just look at the photons.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, and then the axion has to turn into the other type of the other type of photon in order to.
Oh.
Okay.
But this degradation is not only for a supernova, but for everything past.
For everything, yes. Right. Yes, for everything.
So that presumably can be checked. Such a degradation happens for everything coming from
the. But the question is, you know, you don't see anything that is 100% polarized. The maximum, I don't know, maybe you guys know better, the maximum I found was like 30% polarized. So, you know, the question is, what causes the degradation of polarization? What else is there? And I don't know if that is very well known or not. I mean, what I was worried at the beginning is that maybe, you know, if this went faster and then down to zero quickly, then that would be clearly excluded. That does not happen. So, okay, so where could this axion come from?
You're not going to talk about the plasma effect?
Yes, I will talk about the plasma effect. Yes. Most definitely, yes. I'm not trying to cheat. Okay. So where could this possibly come from? So anytime there is an axial symmetry spontaneously broken, there would be a particle like this appearing in the spectrum, and its mass is protected by a shift symmetry. So having a very small mass for an axion is not as big a problem as having, for example, the quintessence mass to be very small. And so in these kind of theories, the axions usually get mass only from the instanton effects, from some non-perturbative effects that violate the symmetry. And so you can see, like Misha was saying, there is a relation between the mass of the axion and the symmetry breaking scale. And usually, and of course, there is also a relation between the symmetry breaking scale and the coupling of the photon to the axion. So we were trying to go through the literature and see if there would be. So first of all, the QCD, the normal Petchel-Quinn axion, can obviously not do this because that would be much more heavy than what we need here. But what we were thinking is that maybe if some axial lepton number is spontaneously broken, then that could give you masses of this order. And we were searching the literature. There was a paper by Nomura et al. Who was actually trying to get axion quintessence, and they had some model where you know, you can easily fit the parameters in a supersymmetric theory such that the mass of the axion comes out to be of the right order if, you know, if you take the Suzy breaking scale, the order of a few TeV. Okay, so it's possible to find particle physics models that could give you this this type of axion.
It doesn't look too fine.
I'm sorry?
It does not look too fine.
Yeah, but I mean, the model itself, maybe it's complicated. I don't remember. I mean, it had many fields. And yes.
Is there any way to check this in the lab if this diminution, like if you shine a very large laser to a very strong magnet, for example?
Well, then, you know, that would mean that the coupling constant would have, just the fact that I tell you that this coupling constant is allowed tells you that it's not possible. Yes? Because people are testing this. People are looking for this.
What can be observed?
People are looking for this in the lab. And
they're not looking in this mass range. They're looking at much higher.
It's
a tunable microwave cavity.
So
I don't think there's any terrestrial constraint on an axion.
Of this. Well, the PDG does give a constraint, as I said.
But that's for the QCD.
I don't think so.
Yes.
Yeah,
but the M doesn't go that far now.
Is there any foreseeable?
Okay.
Well,
terrestrial constraint, no, but you know, if there is another supernova explosion close by, then, like, you know, the 1987A, then hopefully that would do it.
Theoretically, if you see it in this way, of course, there is no problem to consider, you know, any light action, and, you know, when reinvested section, the value section, you know, when you just said, okay, let's say that it's coupled to some super heavy theorem, and it's enough to have an arbitrary mass of axion, because, you know, it depends how heavy it may be. No, it was just kind of theoretical. So it's not the point that you cannot invent a model where mass is as small as you like, right? Rather the problem, what do you do is that to check or just compare it to some other way.
Okay, so then again the question is, you know, how large the contribution to the energy density of this particular axion would be, and it turns out that since the coupling is very small, it would be out of equilibrium from a very early time, and from the coherent oscillations you can actually find that in this particular model that we looked at, you know, the axion energy density would be very small compared to radiation all the way until some extremely tiny energies. So that's not a problem. So now let's get to Anne's question.
Excuse me, this, do I understand you correctly? Say, let's say somewhere in some place in universe we have a domain of abnormally high magnetic field.
Yes.
Then this domain is going to be screened because the light which goes through this domain loses lots of photons and instead emit axions which okay. we cannot detect in our accelerators.
Okay,
right?
So, but usually...
It will be kind of a darker spot on the sky, right?
Okay, so this is tied into the discussion of the plasma effects, okay? Because usually the point is that where you have large magnetic fields, you have also very large matter densities, okay? Now, so until now I have completely ignored the fact that, you know, photons can also oscillate, can scatter on matter, on electrons, on free electrons, and that would effectively introduce a photon mass into this mixing matrix, okay? Which would be basically have the same effect as the axion mass. But the worry is that maybe if this photon mass is too large, then it would cut off the oscillations too early, or maybe not cut off, but introduce energy dependence, and that could be a problem. Okay. So this is then the mixing matrix in the presence of free electrons, where this the plasma frequency depends on the free electron density, and then the oscillation probability would be modified. Okay. So again, if the photon mass is too large, the oscillations would be either just too small or energy dependent, contrary to the observations. Okay, so originally we did not worry about this because we calculated, you know, what the what the free electron density would be, assuming that everything is uniformly distributed and ionized, and we found a number that would be just barely too big for us. But we saw that, well, it's definitely not ionized and it's definitely not uniformly distributed. Now, what these people, Defaye et al., pointed out is that, yes, a lot of matter is ionized, even though it's in very small density, but it's photoionized, so it's not thermally ionized. So then we have to worry about the fact, what is this number going to turn out to be too large and introduce either energy dependence or cut the oscillations down to two small values or not. Okay? So what we did was we plotted what value of the photon mass would still be acceptable experimentally in order for this mechanism to work. And experimentally what they see is that the energy difference in those two bins were the intensity difference in the two bins that they are measuring the light from the supernovae should be less than 3%. So from this you can see that basically the plasma frequency should be less than about 6 times 10 to the minus 15 electron volts, and which would correspond to a value of the order of 2.5 times 10 to the minus 8 electrons per cubic centimeter. Again, as I said, if everything was completely uniformly distributed and everything, all baryons would be ionized, then you would get a number that is too big. Okay? So then that would be a problem. However, luckily, matter is not uniformly distributed. How variants are distributed in the universe is an open problem, of course, but people have a very good idea how this happens from models, even and but not from direct observations. So there are four groups of four types of baryons that are condensed in stars and galaxies, hot baryons in clusters of galaxies and groups, warm hot intergalactic matter, and then the photoionized intergalactic gas, also known as Lyman alpha forests. Okay, so the first three group of baryons is very, very strongly clumped, makes up a tiny fraction of the universe, so that will not be important for our considerations. So that means that all that is left is, and about two-thirds of baryons is in these first three categories. So about one-third of the baryons is ionized is in Lyman alpha forests. So the question is, how is this distributed over the universe? So first of all, there is no direct observation on the distribution of this kind of forests, and for very high redshift, it is indeed likely that it is uniform.
But for very high redshift, it's not going to be ionized.
Yes, I agree. And it's also not the interesting region for us. So
this is, what you're saying is that the only constraint on how uniform it is now.
So what I'm trying to see is how uniform, exactly. The question is, how uniform is it for z less than 1? And it turns out that for z less than 1, these Lyman alpha forests themselves are are somewhat clumped, not as much as the first three categories, but they are clumped. And all the observed Lyman alpha forests are actually around galaxies, and models suggest, for example, a model of Silk suggests that like 97% of the volume of the space is underdense at least by a factor of 10. So then I gain the factor of 10 here and the factor of a 3 from the fact that only one third is. So this will put the energy, the electron, free electron density in the region where it is safely under control and no energy dependence would be introduced. In fact, you could look at it from a different direction, since this is actually in the region that is close to this photon mass, would be close to the axion mass. This would tell you that I don't have to pick the value of the axion mass to be exactly 10 to the minus 16 electron volt, because the scale of that order naturally appears from the photon rescattering on electrons.
Could your axion be massive?
Probably not, because like we heard before, for larger values of z, this effect of the plasma probably goes away, and I have to protect still the C and B photons. So somehow,
it couldn't be much lighter.
But okay, now, is there any way to test this scenario? Of course, the best would be to observe this axion directly or improve the bound on the coupling by a factor of 10 or 15, and that's probably possible if there is another supernova explosion close by. You could exclude the model by saying that there is no way there are this big magnetic fields in the universe, though the bounds on to improve the bounds on B is very unlikely, because the matter density in these regions is very, very small. Okay, then there's one interesting way to try to see if there's any correlation between intergalactic magnetic fields and the intensity of supernovae observed, because our curve is only an averaged curve. So if there are larger domains or some correlations between the directions, then of course an observed supernova could be lying outside of this curve relatively much.
How many domains does a photon see?
About 4,000. Okay. Yeah. If the domain size is 1 megaparsec. Or I would think that maybe the most promising way would be to find independent confirmation about the nature of the dark energy. For example, if by galaxy counts, and there is a planned survey that would do something like this within 5 years, if you could really say that the equation of state of this dark energy is really close to minus one, then of course our model would be not excluded but unimportant. Or maybe you could improve the bounds on the energy dependence or observe it in the next, on the energy dependence in, of the dimming of the supernovae. Maybe in the next supernova measurements you could do this. So, to conclude, we think that the supernova measurements are very exciting because they test a length scale that has never been tested in physics before and indicate that there is some interesting new physics happening at these scales. We think that this photon axion oscillation mechanism is a viable alternative, and here is the parameter that we would need in order for this to happen, and there are some ways to distinguish this scenario from the usual one, though admittedly there is no smoking gun one way to test it. Probably the best would be to try to do all of this and see if the model makes sense or not. Okay, thank you very much. Yes.
If you take your model with your parameters for the axion mass,
yes,
and go, say, into a typical star with the magnetic fields typical in, say, let's say, on this sun, which are much larger than that,
yes,
the
minus 9,000, yes,
what oscillation length would come out there?
I would need to know what the size of the magnetic field is, yes?
Well, let's say,
it is
at least the
bigger
100 Gauss or something, right?
So it's 100 Gauss? Okay,
yeah.
So then it would be, let's say, so the oscillation length now, so the oscillation length now is of the order of let's say, 1,000 megaparsec.
Yeah.
And that's for 10 to the minus 9 Gauss.
So it's like 11 orders of magnitude.
That's right, yes. Yes. That's right.
So can it be somehow already, or it's still too large? It's too large.
No. Otherwise there would be a bound on...
Well, that's how they are.
That's right.
And that's how they are.
Bounds from the supernova.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, so this is really outside the all possible bounds that people could think about, from the sun, from supernova explosions, from terrestrial experiments. This is outside, but not very much, just a factor of 4 or 5 outside. So,
okay. Was it a complete accident that the same scale came out twice, the plasma frequency scale,
yeah,
and just a complete numeric loss?
Yes. Maybe you can explain. You can explain anything, yes.
It sounds like it's very difficult.
It's very hard to distinguish, yes.
Any volume test?
Yes.
Volume test. Number count.
Yes, galaxy counts.
Measure the number in the box.
Yes.
We should have lots of
those. No, but I think, as far as if I understand correctly, it's just an invitation, because you are saying, okay, the dimming of the distant stars is because of oscillation.
Yes.
So there is a problem of providing something in the universe with a negative pressure, right, in order to...
That's right.
So you say, okay, maybe there is a developed network of cosmic
streams,
yes, but then... Why not focus on the search for the network of a cosmic streams? Because these are quite a spectacular phenomena,
fine,
right? And
yes,
if you have a particular model for the network of the cosmic streams, that's where to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that maybe not for
the CMP. Yes, a cosmic microwave ground definitely sets a limit because any network of topological defects ruin anisotropy.
Mm-hmm.
So you better make your cosmic streams so weakly interacting, yes, that anisotropy is not ruined, right? And it's a very strong limitation, yes, on the model.
Any other alternatives to have a source of that would give you omega negative?
We haven't thought very, very hard about
it. You have to be in trouble with all the other things.
Yes, we haven't thought very hard, so I wouldn't say yes or no. Yes?
I'm trying to say this, David. The fact that you need these cosmic strings, are you saying that independently of the supernovae, we now know that 70% of the mass in the universe is something more exotic than particles?
That's all it seems like.
I mean,
yes.
Before supernovae,
it's before supernovae, yes,
measurements are popping out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, from CMB. CMB. Just from cut. Yes.
Oh, you still say CMB.
CMB.
Once you know,
so you have to mess. We haven't tried messing with CMB yet.
But it has to be negative pressure.
Well, because it shouldn't clump. So
it's very diffused all over. Yes. Otherwise, it would be like galaxies, but built from something else.
Yes.
Right?
It'd be harder. So CMB tells you it's flat. And it also tells you a little bit about the matter, but basically, yeah, you can measure galaxy properties, cluster properties, and all of that tells you that the clump matter is 0.34. So anything else?
Let's see. This tells you that any. So if you see a gamma ray burst.
Yes.
This, that's right. In a third of that energy,
yes,
is
axial. Yes.
But is there any way of observing those intense axion beams?
I don't think so, because that's why they are invisible axions, because you see them only after you turn them into photons.
Well, the only way to observe axions of this type is to make it the inverse process. You have a big, yeah, domain of strong background field, and then out of nothing comes a beam of the photons,
yes,
right? That's how you'd observe it. Mm-hmm. But where do you get strong magnetic field?
That is very, very long. Yes.
I have a question, just probably better addressed the astrophysicist in the room. By the galactic lens of a distant object, polarizations of the two random objects generally identical.
So you can get some rotation, but
you can get rotation from the plasma.
You can, depending on the structure, for a complicated lens, you can actually get rotation from the lens. But I don't think that
that measures. But it would be, in this model, some fluctuation in the amount of polarization, just depending on your two different paths, you're going to pass the different domains, and by chance, you might see something.
It would also be different, right?
But that would be hard to correlate.
Well, so a lensing model would tell you what you would expect, and then you would observe something different, and the difference would actually be larger.
It's true, but I mean, the polarization would be less than 10. I think you have to know more about the matter.
Yeah.
But there's also a way, because clearly there's no impact on radio. Right?
Yes, so no impact on that.
Somehow correlating radio and optical.
No.
In these cases.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Oh, for a lens, right?
Mm-hmm. I see, yes.
Which you do, which are both radio and optical.
Yes, that would be interesting. Yes.
Okay. Shout out again.